Okay, first off, I have to apologize for the time between episodes. 2018 was a year of event, yes, with a capital E for me, which meant that, unfortunately, projects like Women in STEM took a bit of a backseat. But it is 2019, and I have promised myself that I would finish this project. We would get 20 full episodes out, and we would be all done. So here we go. This episode's guest is Dr. Carmel O'Brien. Dr. O'Brien is currently a principal research scientist with Monash University and the CSIRO. She's exploring biomaterials and stem cell innovations. So let's jump right in and find out how Dr. O'Brien became interested in STEM.
Okay, so I don't have this sort of light bulb memory moment of that's it, I'm going to be a scientist, but I think when I reflect growing up, I was a very inquisitive child and I read a lot of sci-fi books, and I was always really interested in the human body and living things in general. So I think generally I had a curiosity. I didn't label that as science interest. And I was very interested in, you know, sort of wow, completely out there technology ideas in those sci-fi books that, you could never imagine even happening. Mm-hmm. So I was always interested in that, and I was good at science subjects at school. But it wasn't until maybe about year 11 when I actually went to boarding school for my last 2 years, and it was quite a focused educational environment. So I'd moved from a small regional town to that school and gone from co-ed to single sex, and I just blossomed at that school. And when I reflect back, I had a chemistry teacher there, Mrs. Woodburn, I still remember her. Mm-hmm. And when I reflect back, I think probably people like her gave me a lot of inspiration to think about a science career. And what I would say is that it never occurred to me after I'd been in that environment that I couldn't do anything. So around that age, around year 11, 12, I was loving biology and chemistry and maths, and managed to burn a hole in my school skirt with sulfuric acid, but I still loved chemistry.
Look, it's not chemistry unless you burn something.
And a bunsen burner. So, you know, it must have been a calling. But yeah, around about that age, I remember I was looking through all the career books and nothing seemed to fit. And I think when you do quite well academically, there's always this expectation that you'll go into medicine or law, if not teaching or nursing. Mm-hmm. Well, certainly, in the period that I was in year 11, 12. And I always remember my mother asking me when I was selecting my choices at university, are you sure you don't want to do medicine? I'm just checking. because I would have got in. And I said, no, I just I think it would be nice to be a doctor of some sort, but I sort of want to explore. So I had this very strong sense of needing to do an exploratory type of biomedical type of science.
Yep.
And it was around that time that I spoke to a cousin's friend at her 21st, so she was several years older than me, and she described this course called medical technology, and I just went, that's it, that's the course I'm looking for. And that's what started me on that path, really. I'm just going to say I did grow up in a very educational-focused house. I was one of 8 children. So even though I didn't really have those science role models in front of me, my father was a very scholarly man, and my mother was a nurse. Mm-hmm. And they always planted that seed that education's everything. You can make your own choice once you've got that.
So what was it about medical technology that attracted you?
I think it was that sort of combination of medicine with a bit more exploration of technology. Mm-hmm. And that was a new word at the time, medical technology. It was a really new concept. I think it was the exploratory thing, really understanding impacts of things on the human body and how we can use that in medicine and, you know, come up with better health solutions and devices and implants, things that are quite, you know, normal, regular speak now. But at the time, it was quite a new concept.
Yeah, it's
really appealed to me.
The field's really grown over the last 30-odd years.
Yeah, a lot.
So what was it like moving into university? Was this still a male-dominated field, or was this more...
I think in that field, it was a biomedical type course. I think you do see a sort of a fairly strong representation of women going into those sort of health-related sectors. And a lot of those jobs, this was a course at RMIT, which was very much geared to doing a two-year placement in a hospital or a pathology environment before you qualified. So it was a great course. You studied and worked and got paid. And so I think a lot of, I guess traditionally, a lot of women go into those sort of healthcare hospital type environments.
Yeah.
So I would say it's probably quite equal.
Oh, very good.
Yeah. And certainly our tutors and teachers, there was a very equal representation. Yep.
So you got your degree from, let me just have a look at my notes. You got a Bachelor of Science, Clinical Biochemistry from RMIT. What did you do after that?
After that, I actually worked in biochemistry laboratories, both in Melbourne and in the UK. I worked in a couple of different places, different hospitals and different companies, pharmaceutical companies. And what I really started to find there, I actually travelled for a couple of years during that period as well. What I really found there was that I had loved clinical biochemistry so much, the theory of it, which was wonderful. And to me, it just explained everything. It's explained the way the body works and the way it doesn't work when you get sick. And I really loved that. But I found going into the profession that it actually became quite routine and, dare say, boring.
Oh, dear.
So I could see a real plateau in my learning curve coming up pretty sharply. So I think when opportunities came along, I was ready to jump.
So how did you find working in England versus working in Australia?
Look, I was quite young then and it was a holiday job. I couldn't really probably give a very good comparison of how it really is.
So I
went back there as a PhD student and a postdoc. So academically, I would say the systems were quite similar. But I couldn't really say a lot about the biotech environment.
Was this the backpacker version
backpacker
of biotech?
Job. Yeah.
You weren't picking grapes. You were out there, you know, doing biotech
exactly.
instead.
Yeah, exactly. In between the fish and chip shop job.
Which one was more rewarding?
Well, actually, the one in New York in a chicken shop was pretty good. Because it was like this... It was like Seinfeld.
Oh, dear.
You know, it's just like everybody.
No chicken for you.
You've got a melting pot. So, look, they were both rewarding in their own ways.
Very nice. Yeah. Now, you did go back to uni and you got a Master's of Science from Monash in Reproductive Biology. And your focus seems to have gone down more towards that reproductive area since then, hasn't it?
Yeah, so that came about really was driven by my change in work environment. First, so an opportunity came along when I was working in a hospital to join a reproductive biology team, and I think they kind of sent it to the pathology department because they didn't really know where to send the opportunity. And I put my hand up because, as I said before, I was really looking for something else. I didn't really understand the opportunity that well. So from there, I moved into training with very fortunately the pioneers of the IVF world, and that was just an amazing experience, and I ended up working in a few of the IVF clinics. And through that, because I had a lot of patient contact and I had to understand their hormone regimens and interpretation of results, and I was also handling their gametes during surgery and all that sort of thing, I actually needed to know more. I needed to understand what I was doing. And at that time, the field... the pioneers in that field actually set up a new course at Monash University around reproductive technology and biology. And so I enrolled in the graduate diploma, just planning to do 2 years. And my boss, Dr. Mac Talbot at the time, was very supportive of that and paid for the course. And through that, I loved it so much that I actually converted to the master's course, which was new at the time.
Yep.
And through that, I had to do a part-time research thesis. So that took me 4 years. And this was all supported by my surgeon boss, mm-hmm. Dr. Talbot. And that's where that was when my whole opening to research happened. I had just never considered a research career before. And perhaps that was the lack of role modelling when I was younger. I just it just didn't appear to me before that as an avenue.
You'd spent a lot of time in industry before that, hadn't you?
Well, I'd worked in hospitals, mainly hospital and clinical pathology laboratories. So there I moved. Then I moved into that whole IVF sector, and that's when I really just thought, wow, this research thing is really cool. And yeah, for me, what I've really come to realise is that I need a continuous learning curve. And every now and then, every 4 or 5 years, that will plateau for me.
Yep.
And I can look back and see that pattern repeatedly. It's not that I jump ship. It's more that wherever I am, I need to be seeking a new role or a new learning curve.
And you've learnt enough about that thing now. Now you want to move on to the next thing.
I just need to be learning to be interested. Yeah, and I'm willing to do that. So I can really see that when I look back, that for me it's about continuous learning.
Mm-hmm. After that, you went on to do a PhD because apparently university is a thing that you really love doing.
Oh, deliberately. So none of this was planned. That's why when people say I'm going to do doink, doink, doink and doink,
yep.
I'm going to go, oh, okay. Yeah, it's very much stepping stones for me. For me, the PhD thing grew out of my master's research with Kate Loveland and Ellen Trounson. I was investigating egg and sperm interactions for contraception,
mm-hmm.
and I learned all this new molecular biology. And I tell you, it was gobbledygook when I first started. It was so new with all of the people who'd come out of the gene technology from America in the 80s, and it was so new that I hadn't learned it at uni at all in genetics. Mm-hmm. So the learning curve was enormous, but I just thought it sounded absolutely amazing, the study of DNA and the ability to amplify DNA. And so when I went back to my IVF job after my master's, I worked for a year full time. Again, I had that feeling of I'm really happy in this job. I really enjoy it. It's very comfortable. But I'm going to be really bored in about 3 years' time. And I could see that really clearly.
Yeah.
It's too routine. Great people. It was a great environment, but too routine. Mm. And I could see the lack of learning ahead and the lack of ability to really progress from there.
Yeah.
So that's when I started hunting around for PhD. And it was a really big decision. I was just over 30.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to Ellen Trounson, who had supported my master's. I saw him at a conference and I said, oh, look, you know, I really think I need to come back and do a PhD. And then the first thing he said to me was, I knew you'd be back. I've been waiting. and he put me in touch with a lot of people to talk to about stem cell technology, which was just emerging.
Yep.
And again, I didn't know much about it, but he put me in touch with all the right people and said, talk to this person. I don't think you should do human embryonic stem cells because I don't think it's quite ready. You won't get your PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But work with this person who's doing something called gene trapping in mouse embryonic stem cells. And that's where my PhD took off. And I made a really big decision around that time to sell my house and just go full time. And I got a scholarship and spent the next 5 years studying full time. So it was quite a big decision in my early 30s, and I was very single at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a big decision, but at the moment I started, it was the best decision ever.
Yeah.
And I was really, really clear on that.
So you've gone into stem cells, which is a brand new field at the time. I mean, hell, stem cells are still drastically misunderstood by the public today, I think. I mean, we're not exactly helped by the shonkies who say, Lee, we'll do stem cell beauty treatments at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And also stem cells is a very loosely used term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did you go from there? Where did the stem cells take you?
So the stem cells took me to Scotland
mm-hmm.
for part of my PhD, and I worked with the world expert on stem cells, Austin Smith, and my own supervisor in Australia, Peter Mountford, and Austin decided to set up a biotech company. So at the end of my PhD, I spent another short period of time in Scotland doing a gene targeting project, which is about going in and converting the DNA in an embryonic stem cell, and it was for a pharmaceutical company. And in that time, the new company, Stem Cell Sciences, was set up in both the UK and Australia, and I came back to Australia to help found those laboratories and set up the programs there. So that's how I moved into that. And I think because I was older when I did my PhD, it was really clear that I wanted to move back into a very application-focused work in the stem cell field. Now, what I should add, in that time, in the last year or so of my PhD, the first human embryonic stem cells were derived. And that really was a huge change in the field. And it also impacted the way our company progressed from there. Yeah.
With embryonic stem cells, how did that actually change what you were doing? What opportunities did they give you?
It changed the way we thought about modelling human disease. Before that, we had never really had a true human cell-based model to do that.
Yep.
It also opened up lots of scary thoughts about cloning and the way we could manipulate that technology. But until then, there had never really been a normal embryonic source of a cell that was human and could become every single cell type in your adult body to work with. And that's a really powerful tool. So around that time, John Howard introduced a legislation for the use of excess IVF embryos.
Yes.
And the first embryonic stem cells that had been derived in the US were not really available to researchers. They were quite heavily encumbered. And around this time, I actually thought, gosh, I work in IVF, and I still did too, part-time. Maybe we could actually join forces and make a resource for our own Australian researchers. And it kind of seemed a bit strange to be asking a private biotech company to think about that. But myself and a colleague did do that. We went to our own board and we went to the directors of the IVF company that we'd both worked for. And we floated the idea of actually making Australia's first research use stem cell lines. And we did that. We got one of the first licenses from the government body to do that. And because it was a pioneering license and it was a fairly ethically fraught, debated period of time, you know, we had to dot a lot of I's and T's and make sure all the consent processes were in place. And it's one of my proudest highlights in my career that we did actually go ahead with and achieve the development of those as the research tool for Australian and global researchers. Nowadays, with all the stem cells around, it may not seem as important, but at the time it was actually enabled research to happen in that field.
You took that first step.
Yeah. So it was a time where I thought, when I remember actually preparing to try and make that first stem cell line from a donated embryo that was consented for use in that project. And I remember thinking, this is actually going to make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was a really great feeling.
Well, a lot of different fields have come out of that. I mean, well, okay, the biggest thing that the public knows about is the fact that guy in China who's decided to genetically engineer those twins.
Yes,
That's one of the things you were worried about in the first place, wasn't it? Because you said you were talking about human embryonic and you're worried about cloning and that sort of thing. How do you feel about CRISPR and this sort of application of it?
My own personal view?
Yeah, yeah.
I've never been a fan of manipulating the human race. I do think those technologies, CRISPR is an incredibly powerful technology and can be put to an amazing amount of good use, such as very efficiently identifying cancer targets and targets for other diseases. So I can see lots of absolutely valuable use for those technologies. And look, it's a bit like the atom bomb, you know. These technologies used in one way can be very good and used in another they're not, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's always been the same thing with any sort of medical technology invention that could possibly intervene in human genetics. I mean, gene editing's been around for a very long time, just in different forms.
Yep.
So I guess the thing with CRISPR is it's quite achievable to do. So a lot of labs can pick up the technology quickly. And that was the same when what we call iPS cells or induced pluripotent stem cells were identified in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, a lot of laboratories that had no skills in stem cell biology could actually take up this technology. So I think it's the same with any medical technology. It's often ahead of the legislation as well. and it requires a lot of public education and debate.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, in my field in technology, we tend to be a bit like that as well. We tend to run ahead of what the law actually says because the law is usually reactive.
Yes, yes. So and I think that does happen a lot in medical technology.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Going away from to less controversial topics, you've done your PhD, you've done this wonderful thing where you've started the first embryonic stem cell line, you've allowed the development of this new tech, but now you're with the CSIRO.
Mm.
How did you get there?
I got there because the company, the Stem Cell Sciences Biotech Company, was actually acquired by a US company. And there weren't jobs anymore.
Oh, okay.
To be honest, it was probably, I spent 9 years with that company. Mm-hmm. And we did some wonderful work around neural stem cell, creating neural stem cell platforms to model neural disease and creating better reagents for culturing stem cell systems. And I was also starting to hit that little plateau again.
Yeah.
So when that time came around, I was okay with it, and mm-hmm. I actually was alerted to a position coming up in the CSIRO that I was well suited to, and it was very much around the study of pluripotent stem cells.
You've said that. Sorry, could you explain what is a pluripotent stem cell?
Sorry, I jumped ahead a bit there, didn't
That's
I?
That's all right.
A pluripotent stem cell is the type that comes from an embryo or from mm-hmm. reprogramming say, for example, a skin cell back to an embryonic state, and it can become every cell type of the adult body.
So it's the ultimate building block.
Yeah. So during development, when a little embryo is conceived, the pluripotent cells are the ones that give rise to the adult proper. So by the time the fetus is formed, all mm-hmm. the cells have come from the pluripotent cells. So that's different to an adult stem cell, which might come from a bone marrow department or a liver department or something like that.
Yep. Sorry, I just needed to clarify that one.
That's right.
So you're at the you've hit that plateau. Your company's just been bought out by an American company, and you're looking for work. And there's a CSIRO.
Mm. So, I was absolutely delighted to go into the CSIRO. It's an amazing organisation with a wealth of expertise and resources and a lot of collaboration between different disciplines. Mm-hmm. So there's an enormous amount of room for growth in your own career, as well as just sheer project work is always interesting and evolving. And I've had the opportunity there to work on many different projects, some of them with developing markers that identify different types of stem cells for the safe application of them in mm-hmm. Medical applications, so that we can pick out the ones that aren't going to be useful in your body and the ones that are. And I've also been able to work on more neural differentiation programs. So we've had a couple of large projects through the Californian Regenerative Medicine Programs, so internationally collaborative. One of them was looking at multiple sclerosis models using mm-hmm. neural stem cells. And I've also, in the last few years, made quite a switch to working with our biomaterials scientists, so people who develop both natural and synthetic solutions for medical devices and cell-based systems as well. So scaffolds and coatings for medical devices and implants, gel delivery systems for drugs, encapsulation of cells. So I've started to work very closely with the biomaterials people, and that's opened up a whole new avenue of learning for me again.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're climbing back up that hill?
Yeah, I guess so. And I really love applied science, and I can see in the field of biomedicine that all these disciplines really need to be working together.
Yep.
So rather than me focusing on my stem cells, actually working with other disciplines that will be needed to make that happen.
So in some of the one of the things I did notice in going through my notes is that you've gone more to, so you've gone into reproductive, you've gone into stem cells, now you're looking at sort of neurological the neurological areas, and now biomaterials.
Mm-hmm.
What would be your ultimate goal? What do you think would you'd love to get out to be known for?
Be known for, goodness. I don't know. That's an interesting question. I don't have a need to be known as such, I don't think.
Mm-hmm.
I do have a need to be contributing to science that I can see making a difference and an impact.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that's very much about being part of a team. So I don't have a driving need to be known as a certain person who's...
You don't want to be the rock. You don't want to be the rock star scientist. Or you could be a rock star scientist. Brian May is.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I could be. I can play the piano.
Maybe even better.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't know if that's a woman in STEM thing or just a personality thing. I find it almost hard to answer that question.
Okay, I'll
I want to be
it.
Known for working. I mean, for example, the stem cell work that we did with mm-hmm. the company, I'm really proud of that. And now I can see I'm working with the Biomedical Materials Translation Precinct, and I'm very passionate about the way we can collaborate across our culture in Victoria, our biomedical culture, because we have a fantastic culture here, but sometimes a little bit of a disconnect in the way we join the dots
mm-hmm.
for industry and research to work together. So I'm very passionate about being part of that so that we have greater healthcare solutions. But do I need to be personally famous? No, I don't think so.
Melbourne does seem to have that core group of biomedical women, really. I think I've interviewed half of them.
You have a lot, actually. Well, I mean, there's a lot of men in the sector, but it's extremely well represented by women.
Yeah.
You know, and look, at some of my future aims would be to be working with those people to really continue building that culture. And there's quite a push now to really get industry and research to connect
mm-hmm.
and not just be talking about it. And the universities are also, you know, facing that challenge of how do we commercialise our research while still asking for academic metrics.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say I'm much more driven by impact science, which I would describe as outcomes in healthcare rather yep. than a paper.
Rather than the academic impact.
Yeah. I mean, it's always nice to get papers, but I wouldn't say it's my key driver.
So thank you very much to Dr. O'Brien for being episode 12 of Women in STEM. I can't wait to bring you the final 8 in this series because I'll tell you what, I am really enjoying finding out about these stories and exploring how these women got to where they are. Their stories have been really diverse. All right, that's it for this episode. As always, the music used in this episode is Coco Coeur by Texas Radio Fish and is licensed Creative Commons Attribution. You can find it at dig.ccmixter.org.